Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion and the Center for Humanities titled Interdependent Personhood and Relational Ethics, A Tibetan Perspective. Our speaker is Sarah Jacoby, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Northwestern University. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director David Eckel.
Sarah Jacoby is an associate professor of religious studies at Northwestern. She specializes in Tibetan Buddhism with research interests in Tibetan literature, gender, and sexuality, and the history of the emotions. And she is the author of a book that I must say I am really devoted to. I think it's one of the great current classics in the study of Tibetan Buddhism. It's called Love and Liberation, Autobiographical Writings of the Tibetan Buddhist Visionary, Sarah Khandro. We are thrilled that she's come to visit us tonight to speak on this fascinating topic. So please join me in welcoming Professor Sarah Jacoby to Boston University. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you, Dr. Eckel, for such a very kind introduction. Really, very kind. It's a pleasure and an honor to be with you today. I'd like to thank Boston University's Institute for Philosophy and Religion, and in particular, Dr. David Eckel, for inviting me here to speak with you today on the topic of persons. This is an important topic in my field of Buddhist studies, if not always precisely for the same reasons as it was for the American personalist philosophy that took root here at Boston University. From what I understand, this lecture series is asking some very big questions about personhood, such as what can the tradition of personalism, along with contemporary investigations of the person, tell us about the place of human beings in the cosmos? What can they tell us about the formation of human communities and the significance of personhood in ethical, social, and political thought? Okay, so we're going to figure out all of this today, right? But first, I'd like to start with one disclaimer. Probably my most relevant credentials to speak about Boston personalist philosophy are that, one, I'm a person, and two, I'm from Boston. And some people here can attest to that in our audience. So what I'll do is pick up on some key elements of the legacy of personalism and extend these into a conversation with Buddhist concepts and ideas. So expect a quick tack in this lecture, then not only from personalism to Buddhism, but also from philosophy to literature. For my key Buddhist sources are Tibetan biographical narratives. As a historian of religion, I would suggest that Buddhist philosophy provides crucial insights into persons, emphasizing their lack of permanence and self-sufficiency. But what understanding one's own selfless personhood meant and still means to specific people living in and through Buddhist worldviews is most richly embodied in the extensive genre of biography called in Tibetan Namtar. My purpose in bringing Buddhism into your conversation about the place of human beings in the cosmos is not necessarily to advocate for replacing one theologically oriented causality for another in arguing for the value of persons, but rather to suggest that Buddhist accounts of personhood can serve as resources for remembering that personhood is only ever possible in relation to the social and physical environment that sustains us. Pooling our global resources, including those drawn from Buddhism, to think about how to better attune humans' relationship with our environment is crucially important. As we continue our march into the Anthropocene, we humans bear responsibility for causing Earth's sixth mass extinction event, referred to by scientists as a, quote, biological annihilation, involving the extinction of billions of populations of mammals, birds, reptiles, and amphibians. If this is the case, why don't we spend more time worrying about this, you know? I feel like we should be talking about this more. We also, of course, have ourselves to thank for the once avoidable but now irrevocable changes in Earth's climate, which are prompting some of the world's leading climate scientists to warn of the foreseeable end of human civilization. It's never been more important for us to remember that human flourishing is dependent upon the flourishing of the non-human, including other animals, plants, air, water, soil, rocks, everything. It doesn't take a PhD in Buddhist studies to see that the anthropocentrism underlying contemporary political discourse, government policy, agricultural practices, and consumer capitalism is leading us into crisis. My thesis today, in short, is that the Buddhist emphasis on the value of persons as an intersubjective value, one entirely constituted by interdependence with other human and non-human elements, can help us remember the vitally important fact that humans cannot thrive or even survive alone. Our agency and our worth as people are fundamentally relational, derived not against but through connections with other sentient and non-sentient forces. So to think this through in Buddhist terms, today I will concentrate on one key word in Tibetan, dendro, and consider its deep resonances in three parts. The first is its Buddhist philosophical meaning as a translation of the Sanskrit patitya samutpada, or dependent arising. The second is its usage as a term of art in the Tibetan tradition of revelation. And third, is its significance in Tibetan biographical literature, not to mention colloquial language, as an expression underscoring the intersubjectivity at the heart of personal agency. Before I begin this, a word or two about what I am not arguing today. I'm not arguing that Buddhism is necessarily any more or less aligned with environmental ethics than any other religion or philosophy is. The Buddha was not teaching environmentalism, conservation, or sustainable development any more than he was teaching people 2,500 odd years ago how to de-stress or manage digital distraction. To reduce Buddhist thought to topics relevant to us today, whether it be environmentalism or another popular one, mindfulness, is to think anachronistically. Human overconsumption, overpopulation, and overstressing were not the central problematics of the first millennia of Buddhist civilizations. That being said, I do think that there's much within the rich treasury of Buddhist texts and practices that can serve as valuable resources for our contemporary predicaments. The resource I'll focus on most today is the Tibetan Buddhist conception of interdependence, dendro, as a precondition for personal agency. This is an interdependence between people, but also between the natural world and living beings within it. In Tibetan terms, it's the relation between the vessel and its contents, which is a word for beings and the environment in Tibetan. Without the vessel of the earth, the living beings who are its contents would fall apart. So they clearly need the support of the vessel. But the word contents is also the word for nutrients in Tibetan, suggesting that living beings provide nourishment in return to the world that holds us. What will emerge in my talk are the ways in which Tibetan Buddhist biographies portray a relationship between vessel and contents that is based on mutual exchange, reciprocity, and negotiation between different types of vital agentic forces, including living beings, as well as entities we would most likely class as things, such as rocks, mountains, and lakes. Before we think further about dendro, we need to start by considering what a person is. Building on the Latin precursor for person, persona, which itself finds its origins in Greek drama, to be a person means to assume a role or character in a theatrical production. In the personalist extension of this Greek etymology, to be a person means to have a role. As Erazim Kohak explains this, it means, quote, to have an agenda of one's own and one's own distinctive style as we go busily and purposefully about that agenda, end quote. This purposeful being, according to personalists, is one who lives in a value-laden, meaningfully ordered world. Here we can detect a personalist rejection of 19th century developments in physical sciences, in particular Darwin's theory of evolution through natural selection, that seemed to posit a fully materialist and arbitrary explanation for the existence of humans in the world. It's not that personalists rejected evolution, but rather that they viewed it as answering only part of the question. In Borden Parker Bound's words, drawn from his 1908 book, Personalism, after we've found that things exist and hang together in space and time, and this is the domain of science in his wording, we next need to know what they mean and what the cause is that underlies the cosmic processes, end quote. This, for him, is the domain of philosophy. Bound describes a type of causality that it's, at its core has a divine origin in a monotheistic creator, one that presences itself in the self-determination of persons. In Bound's words, it is, quote, an abiding power which can form plans, foresee ends, and direct itself for their realization. Therefore, a person, in the personalist sense, is one who inhabits a world of good and evil, whose sense of agenda is not arbitrary, but endowed with a capacity to cherish, grieve, and respect. A person, in this process-oriented, normative sense, is one who can be nurtured and educated to embody a fuller humanity, which I understand was the mission of generations of faculty inspired by personalist philosophy here at Boston University. If we can trace the roots of Dr. King's civil rights activism to conceptions of the worth and dignity of all persons as self-determining agents in a moral universe, bolstered by his personalist philosophy, we can trace the roots of Thich Nhat Hanh's peace activism to Buddhist conceptions of persons. The category of the person sounds rather different with a Buddhist lens than it does for personalists. To understand how that is, first we should think about what a person is in Buddhist terms, and second, what it is not, which is separate and permanently existent. I'll do this primarily through the Tibetan language, since it is the language that I'm most familiar with in the Buddhist domain. So the Tibetan word for person is kangzak. The first part of this word, kang, means to fill, and the second, zak, means to leak, to drip down, to flow out. We've moved far already from the Latin persona, referring to taking roles in a drama, to a word that seems to describe the flesh in a more visceral way. It's important to note that this is not an indigenous Tibetan word, but rather a translation of the Pali word for person, pugala, or pudgala in its Sanskritized form. Translation gives us hints into how people understood deeply resonant categories such as personhood, for often in the act of translation, you have to pick one interpretation for a richly complex word. You have to make a choice about what an idea really means. In this case, it seems that the Tibetans etymologized pudgala into two parts, pur to fill or fulfill and gul to drop, to vanish, to disappear. Both of the Sanskrit and the Tibetan words used here are liquid, flow-oriented, and process-oriented, characterized by swelling and leaking. Sounds great, right, to think of your personhood in such a watery kind of metaphoric world, but that's what it is. And it's really old. It's attested to in the Tibetan sources by the early 9th century. The royal translation committees defined pudgala, kangzak, as, quote, from birth to maturation, one fills out, and from maturation to death, one runs down or oozes. Nice, huh? This is not originally Buddhist. It goes way back, even older than that, to another renouncer Indian tradition, the Jaina tradition. And you can see in Jain texts, such as the one I'm quoting here, pudgala is defined as one whose nature is filling up and dissipating. So we see directly where Tibetans got the category of the person. But what Buddhists in Tibet do is they add to an old word a Buddhist valence to it. So the Tibetan Chinese Encyclopedia adds that a person is an ordinary or holy being imputed independence upon any among the five aggregates. So now we're entering into Buddhist philosophy, which probably means little to those outside of it. So just briefly, the five aggregates or bundles are what makes up a person. So you have form, that's bodily phenomena. You have sensation, feelings, good, bad, neutral. You have perception, the ability to look at something and say, that's a chair. You have mental formations. This is the collection of desires, wishes, tendencies. Now that I've perceived that's a chair, I want to sit down. I'm tired. The wish, the volition, that's this fourth category. And then you have consciousness. The consciousness in Buddhism is defined as when a sense faculty comes into contact with a sense object. Personhood, in Buddhist terms, is a combination of parts, these parts. that cohere for a temporary period of time and then dissipate. What personhood is not is a self. In Dunkar Lozang Trinley's words, in his White Conch Encyclopedia, he explains it this way. The coarse selflessness of persons is their lack of permanent singularity and autonomy. And what is asserted to be the subtle selflessness of persons is their lack of possessing material substance capable of being self-sufficient. So here we've seen a complex of words used to describe what a self is, which Buddhists are denying, right? Buddhists are saying a self is permanent, singular, autonomous, and self-sufficient, and you don't have one because you are not those things, essentially. So you may be asking yourself right now, why does this even matter? Don't you wonder that a lot when you listen to academic lectures, right? Why does this even matter? It matters a lot in a Buddhist frame because fixating on the self of persons, and again, I'm quoting Lozang Trinley's dictionary, is the root of whatever suffering arises in the three realms of cyclic existence. So this is why we suffer. Grasping at a self is the source of suffering because we are misperceiving the world when we think of ourselves as permanent, separate, and autonomous. We are trying to force something fluid, always in flux, impermanent, and contingent into something stable, concrete, and unchanging. After all, our personhood is as kangzak, exists only in dependence upon something that is temporarily swelling and leaking. It should also be noted that this sense of personhood, what a person is not unique to humans in the Buddhist frame, but rather to all beings cycling through existence, including animals. So this brings us to the first part of our analysis of dendro as a Buddhist philosophical term explaining the nature of causality that leads beings through existence after existence. Buddhists would agree with personalist philosophy that persons are moral agents operating in a moral universe, even though they are selfless. This cycling through existence that persons are doing in a Buddhist frame is perpetuated by ignorance, one form of which is grasping at a self, as we've just seen. Buddhists have articulated a theory of causality explaining how beings come to suffer in a step-by-step manner, how this process continues, and importantly, how it can be reversed. The Buddhist philosophical meaning of dendro is this causality that drives an ongoing process of existence. Dendro is a translation of this Sanskrit term, and its Tibetan etymology means something like occurring in dependent connection. Put simply, nothing exists on its own. Everything and everyone is related through a type of causal dependence. Buddhist scriptures describe this as follows. That being, this comes to be. From the arising of that, this arises. That being absent, this is not. From the cessation of that, this ceases. This causal dependence lies at the heart of the Buddhist explanation of how the world and beings within it, the vessel and its contents, came to be, instead of positing the existence of a creator God. Buddhist emphasis on causality and not divine creation is why Buddhism is often seen as a science-friendly religion. It also pertains directly to our topic of whether Buddhism contains possible resources for an environmental ethic. Because dependent arising can sound like a very ecologically friendly concept, particularly when we tweak our translation of it a bit to sound something more like interconnectivity or interdependence. But before we weigh in on whether dendro as Buddhist causality is instructive for ecology, let's take a closer look at what type of causality this is. Over time, early Buddhist texts developed 12 links or stages of dependent origination that explain how the wheel of life, samsara, turns. This wheel of life is depicted in this way, and it's traditionally painted on the outside walls of Buddhist temples as a tool to explain beings' place in the cosmos as well as their path to liberation. So in one very brief sentence, the root are the three poisons. The pig represents ignorance, snake, hatred, bird, desire. Positive deeds lead one upwards. Negative deeds lead one downwards. The workings of karma. There's six realms in which one can be reborn. The big ugly dude surrounding the wheel of life is a personification of karma as a kind of judgment. It's not a real guy in Buddhism, but rather a kind of portrayal of karma And what I'm going to talk about now is the outer ring, the 12 links of dependent origination. Recent scholarship suggests that these 12 links did not exist as a fixed set until after the lifetime of the Buddha, but they are attested to in the early Buddhist canon, the Pali canon. Based on the 12 links of dependent arising alone, I would wager that most environmentalists would be hard-pressed to find in this a theory of ecological balance or a philosophy of nature. Buddhist causality is soteriologically oriented, meaning it's aimed at liberation from suffering pervading the world. Hence, Buddhist ecology skeptics such as Ian Harris, Lambert Schmidhausen, and others classify early Buddhism as a world-denying religion, not one embracing the wonders of the interconnected web of life sustained in the biosphere. It should also be noted that dependent arising and the wheel of life more broadly are distinctly anthropocentric in the sense that they explain the workings of rebirth from a human-centric stance. Human life is the best position in which to be reborn in the six realms in the middle there. And reversing the 12 links, the pictures we just went through, requires a human intellectual capacity. The natural environment does not have much of a role in these 12 links either, nor does a conception of nature having intrinsic value make much sense in a Buddhist frame, since personhood and phenomena are characterized as being empty of essence, radically contingent, causally determined, and not self-sufficient. I'm not convinced that there's even a word in Tibetan, aside from neologisms, that corresponds to nature in the sense we often use it as wilderness, which is, of course, a topic that Dr. David Eckel has written about right here. However, fast forward a few thousand years, and what you find is that modern Buddhist leaders are, in fact, describing Dendrel in its Buddhist philosophical sense of dependent arising in distinctly eco-friendly terms. In the forefront of this, we find Thich Nhat Hanh, who we just encountered a few slides ago with Dr. King, who's written prolifically and beautifully about what he calls interbeing. My favorite example of this is his commentary on the Heart Sutra, the new edition of which is called The Other Shore. If you read one modern Buddhist book, I would recommend this one, truly. My students read it in my class sometimes, and they all love it. Many of you may already be familiar with Thich Nhat Hanh, but here's just a brief taste of what dependent arising sounds like in his idiom. If you are a poet, you will see clearly that there's a cloud floating in this sheet of paper. Without a cloud, there can be no rain. Without rain, the trees cannot grow. And without trees, we cannot make paper. The cloud is essential for the paper to exist. If the cloud is not here, the sheet of paper cannot be either. So we can say that the cloud and the paper inter are. Because we inter are, our human thriving happens only in symbiosis with non-human elements. So since, say, my body is made up of over 60% water, it follows, according to Thich Nhat Hanh's logic, that I should care about keeping Lake Michigan clean, which is the main source of my drinking water in Chicago. We could say the same thing for the Quabbin and Wachusett reservoirs, I think, is your source of water in Boston. Some people are nodding, so maybe I got that right. So the boundaries of my body are porous. Again, we're stuck in water metaphors. It must be traveling to be near the ocean that gives me so much water metaphor here. The misperception that what I feel is me is autonomous, self-sufficient, and permanent is a source of my own suffering. Getting back to Buddhist definitions of selflessness, because forgetting my reliance on Lake Michigan, on everything not me, around me, reduces not only Lake Michigan's sustainability, but also my own, for the two are inseparable. We can find environmentally friendly logic similar to this elsewhere, in the modern Asian Buddhist world as well. A good example is the first book ever written in the Ladakhi language, which is literary Tibetan, about ecology, which is called, guess what? Dendrel, translated here as interdependence. We can see the newness, though, of the concept of ecology in Ladakh, northwestern India, in 1987, given that when the author Thupsten Paldin refers to ecology in the book, he calls it by the traditional Tibetan word, and I've underlined it in red there, ecology, right? So he's just doing a sound translation because dendro means something in Tibetan, right? So it you can't totally just bring it over like that and talk about dendro when you're talking about the environment right away in 1987. And we should also note that Toups Denpalden did not come up with this discovery of the relationship between dendro and ecology by himself, secluded on a remote Himalayan mountaintop. For the organization that sponsored this book, the Ladakh Ecological Development and Environmental Group, was founded by the environmentalist and critic of economic globalization, Helena Norberg Hodge. So in this interdependent world, it becomes difficult to iron out the Buddhist from the non-Buddhist, the indigenous Himalayan from the foreign influence at play in the production of a book like Dendro. Scholars such as Tony Huber have characterized instances such as this one as emblematic of what he terms the modern invention of a seemingly traditional green Tibetan identity, which is being promoted by the 14th Dalai Lama and the Tibetan exile government. In his article on green Tibetans, he suggests that, quote, "The critical or cynical observer may be tempted to readily dismiss much of the content of green Tibetan representations as anachronistic, exaggerated, romanticized, inaccurate, and so on," end quote. I'm inclined to agree with many aspects of Huber's argument about the anachronistic nature of the association between Tibetans and environmentalism as we understand the concept today. One quick glance at the shift from the 12 links of dependent arising that I just showed you to Thich Nhat Hanh's interbeing serves to promote the point, to prove the point. However, there's a danger in taking this critique too far. If the 14th Dalai Lama thinks environmentalism is an important Buddhist value and tours the world saying so, and Thich Nhat Hanh agrees with him, is it really our role to second-guess the authenticity and Buddhist credentials of their statements? If we Buddhist studies types have learned anything, we should know that the oldest Buddhist tradition is change, and modern Buddhists' embrace of environmental ethics is one potentially fruitful instance of this. So we've now noted that there's a big difference between what we may term traditional or canonical Buddhist interpretations of interdependence and modern versions of it. Next, I'd like to move to an intermediate position between canonical and modernist interpretations of dendro, one grounded rather literally in Tibet, beginning in the 11th century and continuing to the present day. My purpose for bringing us into the second meaning of dendro, as it appears pervasively in Tibetan biographies of a specific type of religious specialist, is to show that dendro does actually have something to do with what we call the environment in traditional Tibetan texts and context, though that something is better described as contributing towards a relational or intersubjective understanding of personal agency than an environmental ethic in the modern sense. The distinction between these grows considerably fuzzier, however, when we realize that Tibetan subjectivities do not always neatly follow our dividing lines between dull matter and vibrant life, landscape to be acted upon, and human actor. And as I say this, I have Bruno Latour's idea of non-human actants in mind, and also Jane Bennett's idea of a vital materiality. I suggest that the layers of significance the word dendro took on in Tibet, on top of its meaning as a Tibetan translation of the Sanskrit word for Buddhist causality, tell us a great deal not only about how Tibetans understood dependent arising, but also about how they integrated Buddhist causality into their own spiritual geography, which was already thickly inhabited by indigenous Tibetan spirit beings, ranks of deities and demons prior to the arrival of Buddhism in Tibet. These spirit beings didn't evaporate or fade away with the arrival of Buddhism, but rather integrated with it, sometimes peacefully and other times requiring ongoing negotiation. So dendro is a term of art, or a term with specific significance in the Tibetan treasure tradition, which is a type of revelation found mainly, but not only, within the Nyingma or old school of Tibetan Buddhism. Specially designated treasure revealers, or tertön, discovered revelations in the form of earth treasures, which are scriptures and ritual objects discovered in key sacred places, and mind treasures, which are scriptures that appear to the revealer in the form of visions, which he or she then transcribes and disseminates as authoritative Buddhist teachings. The Tibetan treasure tradition traces its roots most commonly back to the 8th century Indian tantric master Padmasambhava, known in Tibet as the second Buddha, because they credit him with taming Tibet's autochthonous demonic spirits in order for Buddhism to take root and flourish in Tibet. Treasures are Padmasambhava's teachings, and occasionally teachings of his imperial Tibetan contemporaries, concealed intentionally for future dissemination when their time ripens by reincarnations of Padmasambhava's original 25 disciples. Dendrel, in the context of the treasure tradition, refers to the complex of conditions that must come together for successful revelation to occur. In this context, dependent arising is no longer the ideal translation of the Tibetan word dendro. Rather, it's more like auspicious connection or favorable condition. There are five integral components of this. One must be the right treasure revealer who's been prophesied to reveal a particular treasure. One must be at the right place, at the right time, accompanied by the right people, who include a doctrine holder, which means a disciple who will continue conveying that teaching, pass on that lineage, and a consort. A consort of the opposite sex is necessary to aid in the discovery and the decoding of the treasure. So there's a lot more one can say about the fifth requirement that I've just dropped in there, the proper consort, which I won't get into today, but I'd refer you to the sixth chapter of Janet Gatso's Apparitions of the Self, or the fourth and fifth chapter of my book if you want to read more about what that is. So at first glance, it seems we've now strayed rather far away from our dendril number one meaning, the 12 links with monkeys jumping around trees and such, illustrating why beings suffer and how to reverse engineer the process. Now causality has to do with personal identity, being the right revealer for the job, spatio-temporality, being in the right place at the right time, and being in the presence of the right associates. Indeed, this list of five conditions to be met before revelation occurs bears more resemblance to an older Buddhist list of five, the five excellences, than it really does to the 12 links, even though it has their same name. The five excellences are the five things that come together for a wonderful Buddhist teaching to happen. So you have excellent dharma at an excellent time with an excellent teacher in an excellent place with an excellent retinue, which means a group of disciples. It's very likely that the similarity between this list of five and the other list of five in the treasure tradition is more than a coincidence. But Tibetans could have called the five conditions for successful revelation the five revelation excellences or something like that, building directly on this list, and they didn't. Through calling the five conditions necessary for revelation dendril, they built on an older meaning of the word as Buddhist causality, thereby underscoring revelation as dependent on causes and conditions in the present lifetime as much as prophecy or divine predestination. So I'll give you an example now of what the process of gathering together auspicious connections, dendril, actually sounds like. This is drawn from the autobiography of the Tibetan treasure revealer Sera Khandro Dewe Dorje, who lived from 1892 to 1940. She's the most prolific female author in Tibetan history prior to Tibet's incorporation into the People's Republic of China, and one of only a handful of women who recorded their own life story in the Tibetan language. I won't give too much backstory about her here, and more is available in my book, Love and Liberation. And also, by the way, I'm currently preparing a full translation of the autobiography. It's actually going to be finished one day. And so there is much more to come about the life of Sera Khandro from me. So just briefly now, though, when she writes that when she was 25, at that time, the auspicious connections, the dendril, for many treasures went away. In particular, I left behind the profound treasures from Drakkar Drodzong called Khandro Gompa Dupe Choter. At that time, the treasure protector, I'm about to explain who that is, actually came, and all the people gathered there saw the auspicious connections, the dendril, fall apart on account of other conditions. But because of the great power of my inferior merit regarding place and time, it seemed as though I had no way to stop the auspicious connections from going away. This passage doesn't tell us everything about what went awry with this revelation attempt. We don't hear what other conditions led to the dendral falling apart, and we don't really get a sense of what all this looked like, right? But it is interesting, the visual metaphor. Other people saw it. What did they see exactly? But Sarah Kondro seems to be indicating that the two conditions of time and place were off kilter, so the revelation could not take place. What I want to think more about with you now is the part of this passage where she mentions actually meeting someone she calls the treasure protector. Treasures are guarded by spirit beings associated with key places in the Tibetan landscape, in particular mountains and lakes. We can call these land deities or territorial deities, and there are multitudes of different varieties. Importantly, these deities are not Buddhist in origin, though some have been incorporated into Tibetan forms of Buddhism. They don't necessarily ascribe to Buddhist virtues such as compassion and non-injury, and in many cases, they predate the arrival of Buddhism in Tibet. Land deities come in two main varieties, benevolent and malevolent, the latter requiring subjugation by Buddhist ritual masters to ensure that they behave. Both types need propitiation in various ritualized forms by the local inhabitants of the territories, of their territories, in order to maintain the health of humans and animals, especially livestock, and in order to maintain seasonal weather and crop success. We're not talking here about just some colorful aspect of quaint folk religion in Tibet. Rather, these deities are quite literally the masters of the territory, the shibdak, and are essential to Tibetan local understandings of place, politics, and identity. And yet, even in the context of scholarship on the treasure tradition, their importance has often been overlooked in favor of focusing on the scriptural revelations themselves, which comprise a good portion of the most important Tibetan Buddhist liturgical, biographical, and historical texts. This may be a product of the fact that Tibetan language revealed scriptures can now readily be downloaded from digital libraries and read in the comfort of one's own office. In fact, the head of the best library of Tibetan material is sitting right here, Jan Ronis. So we can thank him for the ability to press download and then get all this revelation material, a different kind of revelation, right? Whereas one has to actually go to Tibet, talk with people, and observe local ritual observances and interactions with the spiritually inhabited landscape, right? It's not downloadable, not visible from here. The treasure tradition is most often understood by its scholarly interpreters as a Tibetan response to intersectarian Buddhist competition, brought about by the importation of new tantric scriptures after the fall of the Tibetan royal dynasty in the 9th century. Around the same time as new Kagyu and Sakya schools of Tibetan Buddhism emerged, we find the first treasure revealers, such as Sangye Lama, appearing. In the book chapter I shared with your seminar, I make an argument that if this intersectarian competition theory explains the origin of the treasure tradition, its ongoing vitality in Tibet has as much, if not more, to do with the treasure tradition's association with local Tibetan conceptions of spiritual geography and political organization. In particular, the places from which treasure revealers discovered their missives overlap, in many cases, with what we can call the Tibetan mountain cult, following Sumten Karme's nomenclature. The Tibetan mountain cult refers to a network of regionally important mountains inhabited by mountain deities, who are the most powerful of all Tibetan territorial deities, who share kinship ties between each other and also with the human inhabitants of their territories. So it's often the case that the political leaders in a particular territory are seen as the grandsons of the local mountain deities. The most important mountain in the Golok region of eastern Tibet, where Sarah Kondro spent the majority of her life, is called Anye Machen, the grandfather of the Great Ma, the Ma being a name of a big valley nearby. It's the abode of the master of the territory named Machen Pomra, along with his retinue and family. And this is what Machen Pomra looks like. Note, there's different iconography for non-Buddhist deities in Tibet. They ride horses, and they're wearing certain royal and warrior attire that's not commonly found in Buddhist versions of deities. So if you still don't think I'm talking about territorial sovereignty, check this out. This is the picture that was in the kitchen of a home that I spent time in often in the Golok region of eastern Tibet. We have a very Tibetanized version of sovereignty portrayed here, right? Mao on the horse. So it's building on an association that only makes sense if you know that the masters of the territory are depicted in this way. Back to Machen Pomra, I'd like to read Sarah Kondro's narration of her first visit to Anye Machen in 1911 when she was 19 years old. That year, Gara Gelse, who's the man she ended up marrying, and several of his entourage were preparing to go to Anye Machen. The nun Samkar Drun and I joined the group and went to Machen. When we arrived at Tachok Gonka, this is the name of the highest pass in the circumambulation route around the mountain, Machen's minister, named Drandul Wangju, came to welcome me, riding an actual horse made of cloud. We went into his palace, where there was a sumptuous spread of food and drink. Greeting me as if they had known me before, he and the queen, children, entourage, and servants were greatly delighted. The gatekeeper warrior spirit, named Dungki Torchok Chin, said the following: "Great female bodhisattva, thank you so much for coming to our land. Stay here for a few days. For the land, we need you to perform a cleansing ritual and offer a vase of prosperity as a means of restoring the earth's vitality. For us, we need you to teach the Dharma expansively. I fulfilled all their desires, and our sacred relationship as land resident and guest became unified." We're about to talk about that more. So a notable aspect of this encounter with the geographic and genealogical summit of Golok is the mutual exchange that goes on between members of Machen Pomra's court and Sarah Kondro. Here, revelation is not simply about extracting treasure from the land, but rather about restoring the vitality of the earth through offering it a special type of vessel filled with auspicious substances, which is often called a earth-nourishing vessel, sachu bumba. This is one illustration of a crucial feature of the Tibetan, of the treasure tradition. Revelation is not a one-way removal of treasure from the earth, but rather a reciprocal exchange, an intersubjective interaction in which treasure revealers inserted sacred substances back into the earth and water, which they called treasure substitutes, or as in the example here, treasure vases filled with precious materials. One may reasonably argue, even listening to this, that this arcane revelation process about which I'm talking still has absolutely nothing to do with environmental ethics. But let me also add that the word treasure, ter or terka, is also the Tibetan word for mineral. So it does have an etymological link with natural resources more generally. And for more on this, I recommend an article by Antonio Turone titled "Earth as Treasure in Tibetan Buddhism, Visionary Revelation and Its Interactions with the Environment." So another very interesting aspect of Sarah Kondro's visionary encounter with the sovereign spirit at Anye Machen Mountain is the way in which Sarah Kondro describes the mutual accord she strikes with them as, quote, something like a unification of the sacred relationship between land, resident, and guest, right? Nedrun Damzik Chikpar Sung. The Tibetan here is more literally land, guest, pledge. And it appears recurrently in Sarah Kondro's writing in moments of successful negotiation between the land, as personified by land deities, and herself as a guest on their territory. I'll read you one very brief more instance of this, in which this same land guest oath or pledge appears. So just to do this quickly, she goes to this place, Zirong Sanglung Monastery, which is a branch monastery of Jodrupchen in Golok, also in Qinghai. And the local land protector deity, Larik Nyense, appears to her and says, "You should make offerings to us and we'll do whatever you want," and then disappears. And then she, this is really interesting. She says, I thought, from that time, from the time I was 9 until now, I've set my mind on the three jewels. The three jewels are the Buddhist things you're supposed to have devotion to, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Aside from praying to them, it seems that I have no custom of taking refuge or making offerings to the land protectors and land deities and so forth. Despite this, because he was my treasure protector, thinking of our sacred relationship as land resident and guest, I visualized him. When I made some offerings to him, I got whatever provisions I needed. So it seems like in the end it was a good idea. I find this passage fascinating because it actually voices a question I've often had while puzzling through the panoply of spirits Sarah Kondro interacts with and how to parse their relationship with more mainstream or trans-regional conceptions of Buddhism. Here, the bridge between Tibetan religion and conceptions of territorial sovereignty and Buddhism is the figure of the treasure protector, the same figure we met above as a treasure guardian, the conduit through which the Buddhist teachings are grounded in Golok. Negotiation and exchange is the currency of the relationship Sarah Kondro describes between herself as a human guest in the spiritually embodied land. This is a relationship based on mutual respect and attunement between human interests, above described as provisions or necessities, and natural resources, which are quite literally Earth's treasures. So finally, I'd like to explain just briefly the third and last meaning of Dendrel that I want to share with you today. So first, we thought about Dendrel as Buddhist causality. Second, we thought about it as the auspicious connections necessary for successful revelation. And third, Dendrel is a common word in Tibetan that just means favorable circumstances more generally, positive conditions, good signs, fortune. In this sense, Dendrel comes together or falls apart based on being at the right time in the right place with the right people in the right mood for positive things to happen. The word Dendrel appears pervasively in Sarah Kondro's writing, 177 instances in her autobiography alone, and not only in accounts of revelation like the ones you just read. So at times it simply means a fortunate or a favorable circumstance, such as in her autobiography when her parents bring her as a child at the age of 7 to meet a renowned lama named Chandrong Drukdob Rinpoche, and he responds to their showing up at his house saying, "It's good that you all came. Since it's a favorable circumstance, you should stay here for a few days." It can also refer to a positive connection between people or an augur that the conditions are right for such an intersubjective relationship. Take, for instance, the time when the 14-year-old Sarah Kondro walked out of her family's estate in Lhasa over to an area where a visiting lama had recently pitched his tent, and he was the one who would end up being her main guru in life. She writes, "I walked around the place where the tent had been, and I found one rosary bead. I thought, what a positive connection. What a coincidence, maybe even, we could say. By invoking the essence of his personal deity," by the way, this means by reciting mantra on his rosary, one day may I attain the mental realization of this lama. I tied the rosary on my neck and returned home." But these positive indications that chemistry between two people is taking shape can also be thwarted by other negative actions and sentiments. Here, the tenuousness of Dendrel comes to the fore, the fact that good fortune can be flipped into a bad omen by others' jealousy and hatred. For example, when Sarah Kondro initially arrived at Banak Monastery in Golok at the age of 18, she was very much unwanted by the jealous wife of the head lama. And here's what happened next. "Then we followed the monastery road and headed up there. When we arrived near the lama's house, the two maidservants of the lama's residence came by, carrying empty pails. Yaksa," this is the lama's wife's name, "Yaksa's nun named Sundutso scattered ashes and did other things. Knowing it was me, she did whatever she could to harm the Dendra, the auspicious connections." Empty containers and ashes are inauspicious signs in Tibetan culture. So Sarah Kondro mentions these to illustrate a situation where her possibilities for a positive connection with Yaksa's husband, the lama she was supposed to meet, are intentionally being subverted through the machinations of people plotting against her. Dendrel, in this third sense, is also about karma, ideas about karma, that the positive connections one can make in the present are a result of past actions and aspirations. And in this, it's very similar to another word in Tibetan, letro, meaning karmic trace, that which leads to your present circumstances. Sarah Kondro expresses this meaning of Dendrel when at the age of 17, she prays to a group of female divinities, or Kondroma, headed by Yeshe Tsogyal, who appears to her in a vision. She says to them, "By the power of auspicious connections from positive aspirations in former lives, today I meet with the assembly of mothers and dakinis. Until the ocean of cyclic existence is empty, look after all of us sentient beings in existence. Dakini Tsogyal, may we become inseparable from you." Finally, the multivalent word Dendrel, in this third sense of positive connectivity between people, doesn't stay isolated in Tibetan books and landscapes, but rather extends out to involve us too in an intersubjective relation. So however you see it, predestination from former lifetimes or just a lot of good luck, the relationships allow the research that I do to happen. In this sense, Tendril is a recognition that we don't actually operate as fully independent, autonomous agents, even if our single-authored books kind of put this illusion forward. Our ability to make things happen, to bring situations into fruition, is a consequence of an entire series of causes and conditions, a web of intersubjective relations, without which we cannot do anything. In conclusion, there are many ways to tell the story of our lives, variations on a theme of singularity amidst others, filling up and emptying out over the course of our lives. I'm reminded of Oliver Sacks' rendition of what is sometimes called the narrative identity thesis in his words. Each of us constructs and lives a narrative, and that narrative is us, our identities. In other words, the stories we tell about ourselves are not subsequent reflections on reality, but rather they constitute that reality. As Jerome Bruner puts this, a life as led is inseparable from a life as told. Or more bluntly, a life is not how it was, but how it is interpreted and reinterpreted, told and retold. If this is true, then it's also the case that the stories we can tell about ourselves are not limitless, but rather reflect the repertoire of stories we've heard from others, among our families and friends, watched on TV, read in books. We can creatively adapt our inherited cultural repertoire, but it imprints us, shaping how we envision and make meaning out of our lives. This is one reason why I think it's important to listen to life narratives such as Sarah Kondro's and others drawn from the Tibetan Buddhist textual treasury, who remind us that the solo-authored vision many of us have of reality is a fantasy superimposed upon a world dependent on causes and conditions and radically interconnected. So that's why I propose that Tendril is worth thinking through as a concept, not just as a reminder of humans' intersubjectivity, but also of our mutually dependent relationship with the environment, or in Tibetan terms, the interdependency between vessel and contents. Regardless of whether you understand the earth as spiritually embodied, and even without calling for some type of re-enchantment of the world, Sarah Kondro's writing serves as a reminder that we are, in fact, guests on this land. We are not here forever, and we are not fully self-sufficient, but in need of figuring out how to form a conducive relationship with the land for our mutual flourishing. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Sarah Jacoby, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Northwestern University. Professor Jacoby's lecture was titled Interdependent Personhood and Relational Ethics, a Tibetan Perspective, and was presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion and the Center for Humanities. Tonight's moderator was Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director David Eckel. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Matt Lissette. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Jack Lepiarz.
Thanks for joining us.